You're listening to an episode of the Allen Gray Podcast. I am Jitin Pillay, one of the portfolio managers at Allen Gray, and your host for this episode. Rather than an explicit discussion on global markets, today we are going to look inwards. Investment management is going through a period of evolution. Change can be a scary thing, but it also provides opportunity for those brave enough to embrace the uncertainty. Similar to the philosophy we employ when managing our clients' money, we do not attempt to precisely forecast macro variables, but we do aim to be on the right side of structural trends to explore some of the themes that seem likely to shift the asset management landscape in the years to come. I am joined by Dan Brocklebank from our offshore partner, Orbis. Dan joined Orbis in 2002 and was responsible for the global sector investment team in London. He currently leads Orbis's operations in the UK and is the chairman of Orbis's UK Executive Committee. Dan, welcome back, not only to South Africa, but to the Allen Gray Podcast. I think you were last on in September 2022, is that right?
Thanks very much, Jithin. I'll take your word for it in terms of the timing, but I definitely remember being in this room, so it is the second time, and but it's always good to be back in Cape Town, and it's just nice coming out of a long English winter to be reminded that the sun does exist, so it's good to be back. Thank you.
Fantastic. And I guess Cape Town is a city that spoils you normally, if it's not gale force winds and rain. I guess a lot has happened since you were last here. These days, it feels as though investment management is somewhat of an extreme sport. But you look in much better condition than I am. Somebody tells me you were recently at a weightlifting competition. Is that for yourself?
Yeah, I was not competing in the weightlifting competition. My son has defied all the family genetics and has become a weightlifter. So I went to watch him in his first competition on the weekend. And it was quite an experience because the supportive nature between all the competitors was really cool to watch. And he did okay as well.
That's very good to hear. You know, I guess they say the commonly accepted wisdom is that if we want to see what the future for South African financial services looks like, we should look to the UK and delay the experience by a few years. So I guess, you know, you are kind of uniquely placed to help us unpack this topic today. My first question is going to be at a very high level, 30,000 feet view. In a world where investors can earn a 4% yield on a 10-year UK gilt or a 10-year US Treasury bond, do we need active investment managers, particularly those that have a tilt to emerging markets or complicated advice structures? To my mind, investors now have a credible alternative, and that's not really been the case since really before the global financial crisis.
I think clearly a lot of people are seeing the rates available on cash at the moment and are saying, you know what, I'll have a bit of that. And so a lot of money has been flooding into cash. I think a couple of problems with that approach is that it's not going to do a great deal to grow your purchasing power. And at the end of the day, it's not the nominal returns that you get, the headline interest rate you get. It's what you get after deducting inflation. So there's a whole debate about what inflation is and whether you can trust the reported numbers that governments are putting out there. I happen to think the official numbers are biased downwards because that helps everyone out. And in fact, the reality for most people, inflation is higher than what's reported. So if you take 4% and then deduct a reasonable estimate of inflation off that, you're really not getting much at the end of the day. So I can see why people are attracted to it. And it's partly because as humans, we tend to sort of look at the recent past and over-extrapolate from the recent past. And we've had so long at 0%. Suddenly, when you're offered a 4% guaranteed, it's like, wow, that's pretty exciting. But of course, inflation now is a lot higher than where it was just a few years ago. So I think there's still a role and people really need to grow their purchasing power over long term.
The other thing that I've been thinking about is you have these what will be increasingly growing liabilities to populations. If you think of, you know, aging populations, worsening demographics, and in order for governments and pension funds and the like to be able to fund those liabilities, chances are you're going to have to take on a little bit more risk in future, more likely in emerging markets, if you ever hope to earn returns to fund those liabilities.
And I think you should also, just having said what I've said, you know, everyone should have an emergency cash reserve of whatever it is, a few months. Some people say 6 months, some people say 12 months. Everyone should have that. And so Finance 101, if you haven't got that in place, then that should be in place. Where I think the cash yields can get dangerously tempting is if people say, well, I think, you know, there's political risk coming up, or or the market's looking expensive, so I'm going to put a big allocation into cash, and people start being tempted by the 4% yields in trying to time markets, that's really, really dangerous, because it's incredibly hard to do that. You'll always hear the story of one or two people who've done that successfully once, but they've never managed to do it over long periods of time. So that's what I would be most nervous about and encourage people to avoid.
The first thing I'd like to chat about is regulation, and particularly, you know, UK retail investor protection has been very topical of late. We've seen the UK regulator probing the largest wealth firms on the services that they're actually providing to customers. And one wealth firm in particular has recently had to announce some fairly material changes to the way it charges fees. Perhaps give us an overview of the regulatory environment as it's pertaining to the UK at the moment.
Maybe I'll just start with this specific example, because I think it helps. It'll probably be helpful for people to understand kind of what's happened on the ground. And you're a bit more diplomatic than I am, but I mean, it's a publicly listed company. It's all public news, so I can share it. But I believe they're the largest wealth manager in the UK is a firm called St. James's Place, been running for 20, 30 years. It's a FTSE 100 company. They recently reported their full year results. And as part of that results package, they announced that they were putting aside £430 million as an estimate of the amounts they're going to have to repay customers. Just to put that amount in context, their market cap was about £3.5 billion. So it's 15% of their market cap they're setting aside to refund and pay compensation to clients. So that's a big amount. There's some debate about whether that's enough as well. Maybe there's no guarantee that's the right amount. And they've been forced to do that because when they look back through their records, they found that they were charging ongoing advice fees to their clients. Not all of their advisors had done at least an annual review, or they couldn't, as a firm, evidence that that review had happened. What's interesting is that this came about as the result of an investigation by a journalist, and that investigation has been ongoing for 7 years. The company has resisted and denied all of these allegations along the way, but they came out with this provision after 7 years of the Sunday Times writing about this. What's forced the shift from them is one of the many strands of legislation from the regulator called the Consumer Duty. So the consumer duty regulations are these overriding expectations, in a sense, that have been brought in by the FCA. And what they're designed to do, or what they essentially do, is to require firms to deliver good outcomes for retail customers. So they're really broad and really principles-based. And it's forced this company to essentially look back at whether they can evidence the fact that they have provided services for the ongoing fees that they've charged. So it's been quite dramatic, and it's certainly hit headlines for all the wrong reasons, obviously, and opened up a whole load of questions about whether other firms are affected or not.
Let's zoom in onto the fees part of the conversation. So for me, it was interesting because it's not just that you're offering the client good value, but that you can evidence that you're charging the client good value. So there's an element of actually doing something and then keeping the records to show that you're doing something. And we can get into both parts of that. But maybe onto the first part. How do you and Orbis think about offering the client value for money and aligning your outcomes with clients? And I guess the second part to that, if we're focusing on advisors, do you think advisors broadly need to change the model by which they charge fees in response to consumer duty?
To a lot of people, that what they're seeing is the regulator pushing on fees and value for money, and they're automatically jumping to the lowest cost must definitely be better. And in some cases, fees are too high, and I think you can expect fee pressure across the industry in different ways. But the FCA has also been categorical that lowest fee is not necessarily the best, and they've been very careful to talk about in terms of value for money. That is a nuanced thing, and that can be very hard. For example, when it comes to financial advice, does somebody want a meeting every year, or do they just want to know, they want the reassurance that they can have a meeting at a short notice with an advisor who understands their situation? That reassurance might be value for money to people. Having the availability of an advisor on the other end of the phone could be real value for money. So there is a lot of subjectivity about this. And one of the things which will be fascinating to see how it plays out is the extent to which the people pushing low-cost options win out over people offering value for money options. At Orbis, we obviously think about things in terms of value for money. We're not trying to be the cheapest. We can't compete with the tracker funds. We don't try to do that. By aligning our fees with the performance of our funds, through our refundable fee structures, we look to make sure that we maximize the probability that our fees represent good value for money. Now, there's probably the other podcast we can talk about that, so I won't get into that today. The second question was whether or not advisors need to realign their fee models.
Yeah.
I know a lot of people are looking at that, so I wouldn't be surprised if that's one thing we see. The question behind it really comes down to what is value for money in financial advice? And I think you can probably justify a whole range of approaches under this model. I haven't heard the FCA say you must charge in this way. But I think you just need to be very clear and transparent about it and have had the discussions with your clients so that there's no misunderstanding. And clearly, what could have happened to a certain extent in this case with St. James's Place is that some of the meetings that were thought to be happening weren't happening. And obviously, that's wrong. So above all, the most important thing is that advisors are actually doing what they've told their clients they will do. And that's just business 101, really. But maybe it hasn't happened here.
It's interesting. It's something that comes to my mind when we think about, you know, offering client value for money, and in particular aligning outcomes with clients. The performance fee structures that we have, I think, are a useful tool in making sure that our fees and ultimately the money that the firm earns is ultimately aligned with our client outcomes. And actually, if clients don't do well, our respective firms aren't going to do well. And I think that alignment of thinking is, it's a good way to, I think, shift the conversation from an absolute percent fee to, you know, is somebody providing value and earning a fee that's commensurate with providing that value?
Yeah. This is a massive debate in the UK, because here in South Africa, people are much more used to linking fees to the performance of the funds. It's much more common. In the UK, for various reasons, it's much less popular. In fact, I would say, I go so far as saying that in many quarters, there's outright hostility to linking fees to performance. There's a good reason for that, and that is because there have been some examples over time where the fee structures have been poorly constructed, and they have resulted in windfall payments being made to managers that have then been able to effectively sail off into the sunset, and even if performance has subsequently collapsed. So I think it's fair for people to be skeptical and inquisitive around performance-related fees. And that's why the structure is so important, making sure that they are based over as long a time frame as possible. And that when we at Orbis and Alan Gray introduced this whole idea of the refund and having the refundable reserve fee structure, it really was very innovative. But I think that's a critical mechanism, because that helps true up the fees as you go along with the cumulative performance. And that was, I remember when Simone Murray introduced that. Simone Murray was the former chairman of Alan Gray Limited. Had other managers ring us up saying, "You're crazy. You can't offer refunds like that. It's crazy what you're doing." But that structure has survived, and we've been able to expand it and offer it to more and more clients. But I think that is a key part of making sure that the linkage between fees paid and value is as robust and as defensible as possible. But there I should also say, there's no such thing as a perfect fee structure. It just doesn't exist.
The thing that comes to my mind on having to evidence the value for money and the advice that you're providing to clients, isn't increased regulation inherently inflationary for fees? Because if you've got all of these enhanced costs that you now need to incur to comply, doesn't this ultimately just increase industry fees, both at an asset manager level and at an advisor level?
Well, it's inherently inflationary for costs, and that's definitely true. Or you can see the compliance teams in all the firms, certainly in the UK, where I see the compliance teams are growing. So it's inflationary for costs. One of the interesting aspects of our industry is that there's never been too direct a link between costs and revenues. And so it doesn't necessarily automatically get passed on to clients in terms of fees, because fees have historically been set by metrics either based on AUM size or based on performance. And it's kind of one of the challenges of the business model and the regulatory structure as well, to be fair to regulators. How do you put a sensible framework in place when whenever anyone invests, nobody can predict what the value is going to be from that asset manager in advance? It's not possible. The other sort of awkward fact is that most firms have got nothing to worry about in terms of complying with consumer duty. But now, as a result of these regulations coming in, Everyone has to do a whole load of extra work as a result of Consumer Duty, evidencing a whole load of processes in much more detail than they ever would have done, and doing a whole load of work that's required simply to meet these regulations rather than as part of an ongoing business. So you've had, in essence, some firms who haven't complied with the spirit of it have imposed a regulatory cost on the rest of the industry, which is, it's frustrating, but it is what it is.
If, again, this is a harbinger of things to come in South Africa, let's start with advisors. You know, what should they be doing in their practices today to get themselves future fit for this, for these types of regulations?
Really, what this episode has shown is not rocket science, and there's no great insight here. It's just that if you're charging customers for a service, you need to be providing that service. And I think that's just business 101, really. I'm sure the vast majority of advisors are doing that anyway.
Again, to come back to the low-cost option for investors that we talked about earlier, you know, I guess both in the UK and globally, we've seen a shift from actively managed strategies to passive. How do you see this progressing in future? Is it a continued trend to your mind that assets tend to flow towards passive options? And in a world with increasingly concentrated stock markets, what are the risks to investors in your mind?
Very simple questions, incredibly complicated issues. We could probably spend hours on each of those. I do think the shift is here to stay. I just can't see it reversing. Active management has a challenge, which is that the fees are always going to be higher than passive funds. It's just there's more work that has to be done. And yet, the process of active management prices up capital at the margin. We cannot all be passive investors. Even Jack Bogle, the founder of Vanguard and arguably the founder of passive investing, said we can't all index because that would be chaos. So in purely economic speak, there is a social good here. Pricing up equities efficiently actually benefits everyone because it helps direct capital around the economy. And that has to be paid for somehow. Passive investing is essentially free riding or piggybacking on all the work of the active managers, and more specifically on the clients of the active managers who are paying for those fees and for that service to happen. So if we just take this trend of everything moving from active to passive, eventually something's going to break. And I don't know quite how that's going to happen. And it is really the multi-trillion dollar question in markets at the moment. I think there are a couple of ways you can guard against it. Firstly, you can see where all the money is going into the big cap names. You can see that concentration. And just by remaining anchored to valuations, I think it can help provide some protection against that. But just as importantly, when you look at individual companies, I think nowadays it's not so much just about knowing you've got a stock that's cheap or cheaper than the average. Finding companies that have it within their own control to do something about that. So companies that are generating excess cash, that can use that cash to buy back their cheap stock, essentially have the ability to do something about the flows which might be against them. I mean, if you look across the small and mid-cap sectors, small markets like the UK, there's tumbleweed rolling around at the moment. But those companies that can buy their own stock back or just keep the shareholder returns coming through have the ability to deliver fantastic returns long term. So we're in this weird paradoxical situation where the longer this shift to passive goes on, the harder it is to remain as an active manager because you're just looking dumber and dumber, not owning Nvidia and all that lot. But also, the easier it is to outperform if you can identify those companies because there are more and more of them and they're looking cheaper. So frankly, I think the next 10 years are looking very exciting relative to the last 10 years, which have felt a bit like kind of trying to swim upstream.
For me, it's interesting because I take the point that if we look globally, passive fee rates are about half of what active fee rates are globally. But I think from a risk mitigation point of view, as active managers, we like disparity in the world. And if we look at global stock markets now, I would make the argument that disparity is high. And so the opportunity for active stock picking looks pretty attractive. You probably can make a greater case for passive when maybe you've got fairly unconcentrated and we have fairly low disparity in stock markets. If you just think the Magnificent Seven is 30% of the MSCI world today, even if you are tracking a passive index, you are effectively making an active decision to be either at weight or overweight those stocks. So the thing I take away is that actually passive investing isn't truly passive, as you said.
First of all, it's important to understand what you think of as risk, because some people will see tracking error, you know, how different you are relative to the benchmark, as risk. And for us, both at Orbis and Allan Gray, and risk is the risk of loss. And popular companies that are a massive portion of the benchmark, even though they feel safe from a social proof type of angle, you know, how can NVIDIA possibly go wrong, et cetera, et cetera. Everyone likes it and all the experts are really excited about it. But that popularity embeds incredibly high expectations. And to be fair to NVIDIA, they've delivered some incredibly high profit growth so far. But when you're starting out at those valuations, the risk of loss is there. And the other dynamic, which is, I think it may be starting to kick in 2024, is that for many in the investment management industry, tracking error is a real risk. It brings in career risk, because a lot of firms can tolerate being underperforming the benchmark maybe for a year, but some clients are very, very short-term focused. And so 2 years is not going to be needed. And I saw data suggesting that the number of our peers globally owning NVIDIA is creeping up. It's certainly higher than it was 3 or 4 months ago. This is for a company that has put on $1 trillion in market cap year to date in 2024, and we're only in March. So you can see almost some perverse behavior in that it's more widely owned now that it's so much more valuable. And I think a lot of that is because many managers are afraid of another year where they've lagged the Magnificent Seven. So you might as well buy the one that looks the most likely to do well.
As you said, it all comes down to how you define risk. Is it being different to a benchmark, or is it ultimately protecting client capital? And yes, the latter could make for a very difficult career journey, but ultimately is what at least we believe you should be doing for clients.
Yeah. And there are other parts of the world as well where you have hugely different dynamics. Take Japan, where the really corporate Japan has spent 10, if not 20 years, essentially diversifying, shoring up their balance sheets with cash as a way to sort of create security in the wake of their epic stock market collapse. Now what you're seeing is that unwinding, and that process is a multi-year process. But these Japanese companies have a mechanism that's essentially incredibly shareholder-friendly at their disposal to help boost returns that presents a very different backdrop to, for example, the US stock market, where all the companies have got as much leverage as they ever should have. They've been doing buybacks for the last 10 years already, and the market's already 65% of the world index. So the contrast between the US and Japan is incredibly stark, in my view.
Again, a disparity. So far, I think we've touched on two main themes in investment management. We've talked about regulation. We've talked about fee pressure broadly. Maybe I can talk or introduce a third one. Over the last few years, we've seen an increased focus on responsible investing. I know Orbis established a dedicated team in 2022 to look after the responsible investing function. From your experience in the UK and in Europe more broadly, how are you finding the responsible investing conversations having evolved, if any, over the last few years? It feels like with an increased focus on regulation and on just real-world realities, it feels as though the conversations have changed, or am I misreading it?
Yeah, you're not misreading it. They've definitely changed. They've definitely changed really dramatically. We always refer to it as responsible investing, but I want to say about 4 or 5 years ago now, this sort of ESG acronym came to be widely used. And ESG obviously stands for environmental, social, and governance. And it was this idea that all of the stuff you needed to do good or to do right in the world could be boiled down to three letters or the three categories. This sort of notion emerged. And very simplistically, the notion that was pushed forward was that companies that score highly on ESG metrics do better. And for a while that worked, but some of the classifications was off the charts nuts. There were some Chinese companies that scored incredibly highly on ESG metrics, despite some of what we might say is going on with their labor practices or from a social perspective. ultimately, those classifications were relatively subjective. They missed out the whole obesity pandemic, the firms that are causing the death through obesity at the moment. So they were highly subjective. But frankly, it worked. And it worked from an asset management industry perspective, because it was a great way of raising AUM.
And charging more.
And charging more. So you had an industry that was faced with fee pressure and a need to differentiate itself. Well, what do you know? Here's a survey that comes along and says these types of companies do better. So let's launch ESG funds, and the stars all aligned. That sort of fell apart in probably 2002 was the big year when there was a big reversal in markets, and it shattered that illusion. And really don't want to make light of any of these issues. They're all really, really important issues. The challenge is that this ESG narrative was simplifying these incredibly complex and nuanced and interrelated things down to this simple acronym. And I get quite worked up about that because I think it was quite exploitative. Because most end consumers, they want to do the right thing. And if they're told by an industry that putting your money here versus putting it here is better for the planet, well, where do you think most people are going to put their money? That obviously, the vast majority of people are going to choose the better outcome. But it was a false choice in most cases. And the issues are so much more complicated than that. And there's so many examples we can talk about on that one. So I feel that we've gone through this sort of mini bubble in ESG. I think the reality has started to set in. A critical part of how all asset managers invest is their stewardship of their clients' capital. And that takes so many different forms. And that's why we kind of wrap it into this term responsible investing. That is really important. We found ways to improve on what we can do. We're always looking for those, and we found that.
No, I think from my perspective, we try to talk to clients about balancing. You know, we talk about the three letters, the E, S, and G. We found a lot of focus on the E, but how do you counteract that with the S, with the social part of the conversation? The other thing that I think has been important, the thing that's evolved our thinking, a company can be an ESG improver, you know, somebody that maybe you wouldn't associate with an ESG leader in their respective industry, but are actually taking steps to improve their positioning. And actually, you probably want to support them on the journey, and you actually probably make meaningful change with an ESG improver that wouldn't traditionally be seen as someone that is kind of friendly towards responsible investing policies.
No, I think that's really well said. And being there when management teams are having to make often substantial investments to enable their business to transition to a new paradigm shift, really, in terms of how we organize society, being supportive shareholders through that is a critical part of active capitalism, really. And this whole idea of if you just divest, it was so frustrating hearing that being played out from so many different quarters. There's more common sense prevailing. And it's also worth just saying sometimes I feel in the UK we're at the center of this regulatory blizzard, and it really does feel like it sometimes. But there is another strand of regulatory rules coming in, which is to try and tackle this whole idea of greenwashing. And greenwashing was when firms were essentially trying to over-portray their credentials on the ESG front. It's very straightforward for us because we've always been very conservative. We just said responsible investing is our approach to it. So we haven't had any of these special categories of funds. But I think the regulator is right to try and raise the bar on how firms classify themselves in that regard, or how funds classify themselves.
Do you feel that the responsible investing tsunami, do you think it intensifies from here? You talked about the greenwashing regulations. Or is it actually a firm that can demonstrate it's meaningfully doing something to tackle ESG? Actually, they're probably in a better position than those that have been labeling things as ESG friendly, but actually haven't been doing anything meaningful in the background.
I'm old enough to know that my ability to forecast things is pretty low. So how this plays out from here, I don't know. I think the debate is much more sensible. I think it's much more nuanced. There's a greater understanding that you can't just make the world better by selling coal. What really needs to change is end consumer actions. You know, if we want to get off fossil fuels, we've got to stop consumers driving and flying and all the things that that's the foundation for essentially for developed world society.
Economic growth.
Yeah, and economic growth. You know, the fundamental challenge here is that there's a billion of people in the global population that are combined using as much energy as the next 6 billion people on the planet. And those 6 billion want to have the same lifestyles as the top billion. And how we're ever going to deal with that, I don't know. We need some really rapid technological progress on that. And hopefully that's the solution. But it's going to be tough.
I wanted to get your take on how you see the landscape evolving for the independent advisor and the independent asset manager. You know, can they compete with managers with large tied distribution forces?
I have low conviction in my answer here, so I'm going to put a caveat out there. I can just share with you what I see, though, is, and I think it's comparable to what you see here in this country, but do you see there is a concentration going on, but sometimes it feels like it's proceeding at a rate that's faster than it actually is in practice. Because what happens is that the sort of medium-sized firms that get bought out, they hit the headlines and you see that and you're crikey, there's another firm that's gone. But what you don't see is the sort of people who are peeling out of these big firms and setting up on their own and starting up new practices. So there's a sort of a constant sort of churn that's going on. And I think net-net, it's clear which way the industry is going in, but it's never quite as dramatic as some of the headlines. I think the regulatory compliance, it doesn't help in terms of having a thriving some small firm industry. I don't think the FCA sees as its priority that they want small thousands of small firms thriving.
Which is interesting because you would think the regulator would want the exact opposite. They'd want a thriving, independent, both advisor and asset management firm industry. Because, you know, if you actually are trying to reduce industry fees, the one way to do that is competition, you know, rather than regulation that could have the impact of actually reducing competition.
Yeah, I think that's great in theory, but we all know that there's a difference between theory and what happens in practice. And I think being in the seat of the regulator, you know, would you want to be a regulator that has to regulate an industry that has 10,000 firms or one that has 1,500 firms? And I think if I was just a regulator, I don't know which one I would pick because it would be straightforward and I could focus my efforts on a smaller number of firms. But you and I might want a larger number of firms.
Which is a shame because I think we've certainly, I think in both of our businesses, seen the impact or the value that's added by independent advice.
I completely agree.
No podcast in the current age would be complete if we didn't talk about AI. So let's talk about AI. What is your view of artificial intelligence and the impact it will have on both the investment management industry and advisors? You know, is it a case that we will also soon be replaced by machines that can pick stocks better than we can and they can construct client portfolios far more efficiently than any human is able to?
Firstly, AI is fascinating and it's been the genie that's popped out to help the stock markets reverse their decline of 2022. And really, it was this amazing force that brought some hope and life back into markets in 2023. If you play around with it, and I'm sure you have done, I certainly have done. For me, it's so far, it's been fun, but I haven't found anything fantastically helpful. In certain use cases, it's a big productivity aid. Our IT developers, they love it because it can be really helpful. But I think in terms of investing, though, the way it'll probably fall down, and again, Simon Murray, my mentor, who was chairman at Allan Gray for a long period of time, you know, he said that the fun thing about investing, or the fascinating thing about investing, is that, you know, it's not like sport. It's not like physics. You know, the rules of the game change based on what everyone else is doing in real time.
And it's emotional.
And it's emotional. And my understanding of AI is that can come across as intelligent. Really, it's being trained on a whole load of existing materials, and it's just taking a probabilistic approach to the question based on what it's seen in previous materials. So I don't think that has the capacity yet to do better than humans when it comes to such a dynamic and adaptive pastime as investing. I certainly approach it with some humility because these things can change quite quickly.
Certainly things are evolving rapidly. And for me, I think about it in two ways. You know, the one is the money management side of it. And to the earlier points, markets, despite being around for a very long time, still very much trade on sentiment and emotion. And I think a human eye that is trying to look through that emotion and make rational decisions, at least as we stand today, the future may change, but I think humans are probably in a better position to be able to do that. The second part that's probably more interesting is, you know, the ability to remove routine and administrative type tasks. Mm-hmm. That is probably, in fact, if anything, that could be an opportunity for the industry where advisors now have more time to maybe spend on the advice part of it, you know, rather than the documenting part of it. Or investment managers have, you know, they're able to dedicate time to the kind of complex decision making rather than the administrative tasks that can be easily taken care of by a bot.
Yeah, one fascinating insight into AI that somebody mentioned to me recently, I forget who it was, but I think if you rewound 5-10 years ago, everyone would have thought, well, if AI comes along, the first thing that's going to be kind of replaced would be truck drivers or taxi drivers. And then they're going to come after white-collar workers. So it'll be blue-collar workers, white-collar workers. But last of all, you know, it'll be the creative industries. Because, you know, that's not going to happen. If you look at where the use cases are, the sort of the music and video generation, image generation, the creative aspects is the one where arguably the use case is most compelling. I mean, for graphics industry, it must be very exciting and creative. And so that's the first one. And then, as you say, as a tool to help white-collar workers be more effective, it's been very powerful. And I don't see any robo-taxis yet. So it's almost as if the practical use cases have come in the opposite order that we would have expected 5 or 10 years ago. So it's another reminder that as humans, we're not very good at forecasting anything.
Yeah, the adage comes to mind. You know, in the short term, we probably overestimate the impact, but in the long term, we probably underestimate.
Well, yeah, that's well said. That's well said.
So, you know, we've talked about many themes today that are impacting the investment management industry, both, you know, asset managers and advisors. You know, through all of what looks like very turbulent times ahead, what are the characteristics that would make both an investment manager and an advisor successful in such an environment?
I was recently asked by someone to come up with a song title that best summarizes the state of world markets at the moment. And we sort of had a bit of fun playing around with the ideas, and Nothing Else Matters was the sort of ideas. There were some ideas bounced around. But I just kept coming back to this idea. If you had to pick a single song that summarized world markets, you know, I kept coming back to that Beatles song, The Long and Winding Road. And because everything always feels kind of unique and special and different. But even when you look back through history, all of the episodes that we're going through have periods where that they rhyme with in the past. And the evolution of markets really is this story of just this road that is constantly evolving. It's being driven by humans and their emotions and a whole load of different forces. And so when it comes back to, you know, how you can be successful from an investing perspective, it's, I think above all, it's just making sure that you keep a sensible perspective on things and avoiding getting sucked into worrying about whether Nvidia or Microsoft is going to be the best stock this year. It's just thinking about ultimately what drives long-term success. It's always very refreshing when you speak with true long-term investors. That gear shift towards thinking about what really matters over 3, 5, 10 years, it's almost calming in a way because you can see past all of that noise and focus on what really matters. So above all, it's keeping a sensible perspective, keeping your emotions at bay, or at least recognizing when you're likely to be subject to your emotions, keeping a long-term perspective and not being swayed by the crowd, being comfortable in your own judgment.
I like that last point. You know, it talks to sticking to your philosophy, and it's probably apt that we've just celebrated our 50th anniversary as a firm. You know, it's keeping a consistent investment philosophy throughout the time, regardless of changing market cycles, but to evolve your process. So it's not to kind of stick your head in the sand. It's to keep a consistent philosophy, but to constantly try to refine your process, your investing process.
It's well said. And we have tools now that could never have dreamt of, you know, 10 years ago, 15 years ago. So
yeah,
that's right. That evolution's ongoing. But long-term process and consistent philosophy, definitely.
Thank you to Dan for joining us and giving us insight into how the investment management landscape is evolving in the UK and globally. It is always interesting to look at the major trends and think about what they might mean for us as South African investors. For me, the main takeaways from today's discussion are: there's still a place for active management and advice in a world of passive investing and regulatory pressure. The fee conversation needs to shift from absolute cost to value for money and alignment with client incentives. And we are all not going to be replaced by machines in the near future. If you would like to get in touch, please send an email to info@allengray.co.za. You can subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcasting platform to be notified of new episodes. Lastly, Allen Gray is an authorized financial services provider. To view our terms and conditions, please visit allengray.co.za. Until next time, I'm Jiten Pillay. This podcast was produced by Volume Podcasts.
There's a song that goes, "Money can't buy me love." And that's true. But then they told us, all you need is love, which anybody with a mortgage will tell you, most certainly is not true. Love won't pay your parking tickets or your student loan. It's also needy. It requires effort, availability, constant care. But more importantly, love requires time. And while money can't buy you love, it can certainly free up some of your time. Time to spend on the things you love, with the people you love. And if you're looking, maybe even time to find the one you love. That's why, after 50 years of investing, we've learned that time is the greatest gift of all. And the good news is, if you invest early, time gives you money. And then money gives you more time to do the things you love. And don't you love that about investing? Allen Gray, long-term investing. Allen Gray is an authorized FSP.